This programme is brought to you by the monthly partners of Reasons to Believe. For more information, please visit our website at reasons.org/monthly partner.
Welcome to Imago Dei, Engaging Minds Created in the Image of God. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. On today's podcast, Ken discusses the cumulative case explanation for Christian theism. What is that anyway? Ken, let's hear what you mean.
Yeah, I'll bet all of our listeners are familiar with ways of reasoning and logic called deductive and inductive reasoning. Deductive reasoning is characterized by if you put your arguments together properly, that is, if the premises genuinely support the conclusion, you can hope to arrive at certain conclusions, right? If P, then Q, P, therefore Q, right? And if you do that properly, you can draw a certain conclusion. Induction or inductive reasoning has a lot more to do with probabilities. I think science is largely based upon probabilistic reasoning, although there are scientists who reason deductively. Today, Joe, I'd like to look at a third form of reasoning that people know a lot less about. It's called abductive reasoning. And abductive reasoning, rather than looking at certainties or probabilities, looks at plausibilities. Abductive reasoning raises the question, could it be that this has explanatory power and scope? And what I want to propose in this program is I think the Christian worldview has a high degree of plausibility. That is, I think that Christianity not only explains meaningful realities, but its breadth of explanation is very powerful. And I'd like to try to illustrate that in our program today. And I might say this. This is the way I reason apologetically. I think there's a very powerful way of reasoning in apologetics that has to do with what is the best explanation. And as I mentioned in our previous program, if you can think back to it, I think that's the way we're made. I think we look at things and ask, how do we explain them? So that's where I want to go, Joe.
Sounds good.
All right.
Let's take another trip then.
Okay, so now this question of abductive reasoning. Lots of people reason this way. They look at plausibility. They look at best explanation. Who does this kind of thing? Well, I think, Dave, scientists do it primarily in forming a hypothesis where they say, what are things I could possibly consider? So I think abductive reasoning, I think scientists sometimes reason deductively. I think a lot of times they reason inductively, and I think sometimes they approach it abductively. And I think part of that is in picking hypotheses that you're going to potentially seek to verify or falsify.
Right.
I think other people do it, though, Joe. I think a great example of this is doctors. You know, when I go to see my doctor, I notice that he listens. You know,
he's a good doctor.
He listens to me. I had a sinus problem or an allergy problem, and boy, I've just felt miserable. And I don't always go to the doctor, but I just told him, I just feel terrible. I have a hard time catching my breath. You know, I have all the stuff draining in my system. And I notice that as a doctor, he listens and he'll ask me questions, and then only slowly will he begin to say, "Now here is how I'm thinking about this." He's drawing a diagnosis. Anybody who is involved in diagnostics is engaged in this way. Think of the crime scene investigator programs that are on television. You know, these people go onto a crime scene, they collect data, and then they come up with a projection. You know, they come up with a theory. You certainly see it in detectives, right? Sherlock mm-hmm. Holmes. Sherlock Holmes would often say deduction, but he should have said abduction, mm-hmm. right?
Wow.
And of course, the analogy that I use, because it's very meaningful to me as a young person, I was always fascinated that my dad could listen to a car engine and tell people what was wrong with it. And I thought it was magical. I mean, how could you possibly just listen to an engine and know what the problem was? What I later came to realize is that my dad was reasoning in a diagnostic way. He had seen a lot of engines in his career as a mechanic, and he knew, kind of like a doctor, that certain engines would exhibit what? Symptoms. So the carburetor problems would exhibit this type of system, maybe transmission problems, some other kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That's diagnostician reasoning. That's abductive reasoning. I think that that's a very powerful way of approaching apologetics. Now, in apologetics, you have differing methods. And I have to tell you, I'm so bored with apologetic methodology, where Christians get together and they debate about the way to do apologetics. And we never spend any time doing apologetics because we're debating what's the proper method. Now, let me give them their due. Obviously, we want Scripture to teach us about the nature of human beings, about the nature of reality, and about the nature of God. So there is a basis for asking, what would be a way of reasoning about truth and reality that is most consistent with Scripture? So I accept that. I'm simply saying, I think we do too much of it. And I actually think if you read the book, Five Views of Apologetics, where you have the classical mm-hmm. view, the evidential view, the presuppositional view, the new reformed epistemology view, and the accumulative case. I think what's very interesting is the last section of the book where they have so much common ground. Mm. And since I like to bring Christians together, not divide them, I like that. And this would be a reflection of a cumulative case. So I don't think Christianity is proven by any one piece of evidence, although the resurrection is pretty strong. But I think there is a variety of evidences and arguments that point to God, that testify to God, that are best explained in light of Christian theism. And if you look at them, they're a cumulative case. So let me give you one example with the resurrection. With the resurrection, you not only have to explain why the tomb is empty, you also have to explain a separate piece of evidence. Somebody is appearing. So if you're a naturalist, you got to explain one natural theory is why the tomb is empty. Another natural theory is, who's this guy who looks like Jesus appearing to people? Mm-hmm. That would be a cumulative type of thing.
Twin brother, huh?
Twin brother. That's the explanation.
That must be it. Okay, all right.
Hidden from view for 30-some years. And
that's right. Jesus had two, and one was sent away in adoption. All right, now, I think one of Christian theism's strength is the scope of its explanatory power. So its power is how well does it explain. Scope is how broad is the explanation. And I think good theories are able to explain many, many things. Okay. Let me illustrate by giving you an example of what I'm going to call the breadth, the scope of Christian explanation. I think a Judeo-Christian view of the universe does a lot to explain the universe. Now, I'm going to get into some details in just a minute. But I think, for example, why the universe is there. Why is there something rather than nothing? I think that may be the ultimate metaphysical question. What, you know, I walk outside, there's a universe staring me in the eye. Where'd it come from? Why is it there? I think also Judeo-Christian metaphysics explains why the universe seems to have had a beginning. And I think that's pretty much what Big Bang cosmology points to. I know there are multiverse alternatives, But basic Big Bang cosmology seems to me to point to the idea that it is reasonable to conclude the universe had a singular beginning. It's also ordered. That is, the cosmos is ordered. It's regular. It's fine-tuned. I think the Christian worldview, the Judeo, the theistic Judeo-Christian worldview can explain that. Abstract entities, things like math, logic, universals, why science works, I think all that fits pretty well in a Christian theistic worldview. It's not that it couldn't operate, I guess, in a secular worldview, but I think it's a much more difficult fit. Why? Because does mind come from non-mind? Does reason come from the non-rational? How about ethics? I think there are universal, objective, prescriptive moral principles. I think the idea that you should not murder an innocent person, I think that's intuitively obvious. Now, if it's not obvious, then how do we argue for it? If God created people in his image, you know, we may not like a particular person, may be put off by that person, but if they're made in God's image, I think objective morality, prescriptive morality, fits well in a Judeo-Christian worldview. And I say Judeo-Christian because I think it's important at times to realize that Christians are deeply indebted to Judaism. Mm-hmm. Now, I should also say, though, that Judaism rejects the resurrection of Jesus. Traditional Judaism says that Jesus is not the Messiah. So there is at points where we would depart from mm-hmm. one another, right? Human beings, that we exist, we're conscious, we're rational, at least we try to be rational, that we're free agents, that we're enigmatic. I like Pascal, he says we're a combination of greatness and wretchedness. That really strikes me. I think human beings are amazing compared to animals, in terms of our capacities to do math, to do logic, to do science. And yet, animals don't seem to be as corrupt as us. We seem to have a moral problem. And then finally, religious phenomena. I think we have to deal with religious experience. I mean, I've had some profound religious experiences. What is the best explanation of them? What about the explanation of Christianity in Scripture? I think those are in need of explanation. Now, so I'm setting forth this idea that a viable worldview should be able to be supported by multiple lines of converging evidence that add support for the breadth of Christianity, and therefore function as a cumulative case. And what I'd like to do now is to touch upon some of the areas, primarily of the scientific enterprise, though not exclusively. I want to bring it back to ethics and religion. But let's talk a little bit about cosmology. In a Buddhist cosmology, the universe is beginningless and endless. The Dalai Lama, in his book, The Universe in a Single Atom, he says the idea that the universe had a singular beginning contradicts Buddhism. He says in that book that if Buddhism were disproved by science, he'd give up Buddhism. Interesting. The 14th reincarnation of the Buddha said that? He did. Now, he says at this point, it seems cosmology seems to better support theism than Buddhism. But he says all the data isn't in yet, right?
Still holding out hope. Huh?
Still holding out. Now, so when we look at cosmology, Hinduism would say that there's one reality, God, and that one reality is everything. So the universe is God. You and I are God. Or the universe is God's body, or maybe the universe is an illusion. So as we start to kind of explain these things, or the naturalist position is that the universe is eternal, that matter, energy, its constituent parts, in some way or another, have always been in existence. So if the universe didn't have a true beginning, then maybe one universe sparked another universe, Dave, and maybe the multiverse is the secular naturalistic explanation.
It's kind of the transcendent or the external explanation. Instead of God,
yeah,
it's the multiverse that explains this beginning. And
so in some sense, at some point, there was something of a material physical nature that always existed.
Right.
So kind of a rock bottom, well, naturalism.
I guess the laws of physics are the thing, is the okay. latest.
The laws. So Stephen Hawking would say that gravity brought the universe into existence.
Right.
All right. I'm saying that cosmology, a singular beginning to the universe, Big Bang cosmology, a beginning to time, I think that fits really well with a Judeo-Christian mm-hmm. perspective. In fact, I've mentioned this before, but I still find it amazing. I was listening to a podcast by Paul Davies, and he said, yeah, I was reading St. Augustine, and I almost hit the car in front of me. I thought, what is Paul Davies doing reading St. Augustine? And he said, well, because Augustine's thinking about time seems similar to the way we physicists think about it today. And I was kind of stunned. Number one, I was stunned that a secular mm-hmm. thinker of the level of Paul Davies would be reading a 5th century church father. But I was also stunned that he seemed to be impressed with Augustine's articulation
insights,
of time.
Yeah,
it just... So the fact that the universe may have had a beginning and that there's a beginning to time, that fits pretty well. I think that idea fits well, and therefore it's plausible that a Christian cosmology is in fact matches with the way the world really is, right? Now, understand, I'm not arguing deductively. I'm not saying I'm certain or I can prove that Christian cosmology is exclusively true and there's no other alternative explanation. But I think that the idea that the universe had a beginning and even time had a beginning fits pretty well with this religious interpretation, this wow. biblical interpretation. Now, you might want to bring other things at some point and evaluate it, but let's go further. Astrophysics, I've talked with Dave and Hugh and Jeff, and they have similar backgrounds in the area of science and physics and astronomy. It appears that nature's laws appear fine-tuned to allow for human life. That is, it appears that there is an anthropic principle. Again, we get into debate about how to explain that. But if the universe appears to be designed, if the universe seemingly knew we were coming or appears as if it knew we were coming, that would fit well with a theistic model. The universe's content, Hugh Ross talks about the Goldilocks effect, the right galaxy, the right kind of stars, the right kind of planets. That would fit pretty well with a theistic orientation. Is there another explanation? Well, yeah, there are. Maybe we live in the just lucky universe where everything, maybe there is, you know, the cosmic throwing things out and we live in just the right spot. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are some pretty smart people who take that to be a credible theory. I would say, though, that... a anthropic universe fits well with a theistic model. How about biology and chemistry? Well, life systems yield evidence of having been intelligently designed. What is it Richard Dawkins says? You have to remind yourself that all of this mm-hmm. happened purely by natural processes. Why do you have to remind yourself? Because the intuition is...
looks like it's designed.
It looks like it's designed. Yeah. Now, of course, people bring in the big argument, and that is maybe evolution is the explanatory theory for how you could explain it without God. But, of course, now I'm not one of them, but there are Christians who claim to be evolutionary creationists, and they actually think evolution is a good example of God. So it could be that even the explanation of evolution could point to God. Now, I don't hold that view. You know, I think there are problems with evolutionary theory, and I think evolutionary creationism has lots of doctrinal problems in lining up the biblical text. Mm-hmm. How about anthropology and psychology? Well, human beings are richly endowed intellectually, but morally flawed. Now there, let me just take just a couple minutes here. You know, what does a Buddhist psychology look like? What does a Hindu psychology look like? What does a Freudian secular psychology look like? That is, we're asking worldviews. How do, you know, what is the basic problem?
They have a model, in a sense, for human nature and how good is this model? How accurately does it really represent?
Yeah, and I think what's interesting there, Dave, is in my new book, God Among Sages, I actually think the four people that I compare Jesus to, Krishna, the Buddha, Confucius, and Muhammad, I think the two most insightful are Buddha and Confucius. But in another sense, I think they're the most challenging. That is, when we look at other religions, they get some things right, but they also get things wrong. But that poses challenges to us. It has certain truths. You know, it'd be nice if all the other religions were just completely false and had no mm-hmm. insights. It's not true. Buddhism has a mm-hmm. lot of insights, I think. I think Confucianism is attractive because it has insights. But when it comes to human beings, how do we explain the human endowedness? I mean, I think our family has probably about the best dog in the universe. This dog is nice. It's loyal. It's affectionate. It's intuitive.
Doesn't have bad breath.
Doesn't have bad breath. uses Listerine. We love this dog. We care about her. She's part of our family. But Lucy, our dog, can't do what my daughter Jackie can do. Lucy's not going to go and get a degree in biology.
Mm-hmm.
Jackie is able to reflect philosophically. She is able to, engage in scientific thinking. How do we explain the endowedness, right? We talk about, elephants are pretty smart, dolphins are pretty smart, but do they develop systems of mathematics? Einstein comes along and says, I think we need to think differently about the universe, and here's a way of doing that. There seems to be this endowedness. I'll put it this way. It seems humans are exceptional. Even some evolutionary biologists believe that. How do we explain the human exceptionalism, and yet how do we also explain the moral fallenness of human beings? I don't think Lucy would be as brutal as potentially a human being could be. The greatness and wretchedness. I would propose that I think Christianity has some anthropological, psychological explanation. I think it does a pretty good job of explaining us. Now, how about neuroscience? Humans possess consciousness and a capacity for intentionality and rational reflection. Now, again, obviously, there are people who are naturalists who suggest that maybe the brain does cause the mind. Maybe it's an emergent. Maybe the mind is an emergent property of the brain, or maybe we can reduce it to a level where the brain causes the mind. None of that's proven yet. Those are ideas, but it would seem that if we're made in the image of God, the fact that we're conscious beings and we can make decisions and we're capable of rationality seems to have some explanatory power. How would other worldviews think about it? Can they do as good a job explaining it? Well, we'd have to see. We'd have to compare them. How about mathematics? Mathematical theories correspond to physical reality. I think this is pretty extraordinary. I mean, let's imagine there's no God, and we evolved purely by natural processes. Why should Einstein, Dave, why should Einstein be able to come up with a purely abstract idea that could then be tested and actually show that he had come up with a mathematical theory that actually corresponds and seems to explain the way the nature of reality is? Now, again, if God is the great mathematician and he created you and I in his image, and we have this capacity to say, okay, he created the world, he created us in his image, he networked us together so we can do math. But what if there is no God? I mean, when I was taking physics, by the way, Dave, that I thought that was one of the most difficult classes I ever took in college. And I think I immediately thought it because my mathematical preparation was inadequate. So I was always kind of, I couldn't kind of grasp where he was going and why he was doing it. So then I started thinking, well, my struggle in physics seems to be that my mathematical preparation is inadequate. But then I thought to myself, why should humans be able to do math? You know, are we just lucky? Is it just this incredible happenstance? Well, according to Hugh Ross, a significant number of mathematicians lean toward theism. Roger Penrose, pretty bright fellow. He said that he thinks math is discovered, not invented. Well, if math is discovered, not invented, I think that leans a little more in the theistic category. Now, not totally. Now, again, we're dealing plausibilities. You could be a Platonic person. Maybe Plato was right. Plato thought that there were certain mathematical concepts that were kind of built into the nature of reality. So you could be a Platonist and believe that, but none of that is inconsistent with Christian theism.
And, of course, there have been lots of studies, Dave, involving animals where it appears that they have limited ability to maybe count or separate sticks out to get a reward or what have you. But that shows the great separation between human beings and animals.
I mean, they always have these shows, you know, where they show birds that are able to do remarkable things or in some tool use and so on.
Yeah.
But it's, I mean, when you really think about it, it's a far cry from what a human being is capable of doing.
Yeah. And we're designing the experiments, too. Yeah, right. We're making them do what we want them to do. Yeah.
There was a 60 Minutes episode where this guy, and he was, I think, a speech professor, but he taught his dog to recognize 1,000 different toys.
Objects, yeah.
And he could go to the toy box and he'd say, get this, and he'd go and get it, which is pretty darn impressive, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's amazing, but imagine designing an experiment to test how much your dog can know. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not merely a degree, that's exponentially. Mm-hmm. Humans can... Well, let's test that hypothesis.
I mean, if we had a child whose ability was limited to what that dog, after many years of training, was able to do, we would say that child was challenged, to put it politically correct. He's mentally challenged child.
Yeah.
If that's all he was able to do after years of training.
Yeah. Yes, we have... you know, teachers and people who are in the process of trying to help educate children, they expect certain children to be at particular levels at particular ages. What's interesting is I was very shy when I was a kid. still a shy person. I still have a certain amount of social anxiety, by the way. Although the Bible says, fear not. Interesting that the Bible would say that. When I was a very small child in first grade, I was so quiet that my first grade teacher thought maybe I was retarded. They used that word in those days.
Word, yeah.
Yeah. So she came over to our house and went through a series of tests with my mother, and she concluded that, you know, I was just shy. Mm. But the point there is you have these anticipations. Humans, the natural human should be able to reach this point, mm-hmm. right? Okay, enough of that. Let's talk ethics. Moral absolutes seem intuitively authentic. Moral relativism is self-defeating. I think we do have an intuition about morality. I think that if you think it's okay to murder an innocent human being, we think you're deeply disturbed. And so the idea is you can't be a normal human being and think it's okay to murder innocent people. Now, again, if God exists and we're made in his image, that makes sense. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm really glad that most atheists don't believe in murdering innocent people, but there have been who have. I mean, Joseph Stalin, he didn't seem to mind bumping people off. Of course, you know, I don't want to misrepresent it. There have been religious people who haven't seemed to have mind bumping people off either. But, I mean, if you think about it, where does morality come from? Why would we think that it is intuitively obvious that people have dignity, that they have rights? Where do moral rights come from? That makes perfect sense, I think, in a theistic, in a religious, in a biblical context. Religion is another area that I think is important. I think religion is a universal phenomenon. It seems from primitive times, going back to the earliest period of human beings, that humans engaged in religious activities. We seem like we're worshipers. We seem like we have a need to propose the supernatural, that we have a need to try to find meaning and purpose. On the other hand, religious experiences seem real and they seem consistent. You know, I've noticed lots of Christians like to hear testimonies. They like to hear how a person encountered Christianity, encountered Jesus, and their life was transformed. It changed them, you know. Maybe before they were trying to find meaning and purpose in hedonism, but that wouldn't work. They tried alcohol, they tried, you know, money, and yet they bump into Jesus and he's able to change their life. And we think, well, why? Why do people have religious experiences? Are they, as some people would say, veridical? Right? I had a dream many years ago. I was 19. I had a dream that I saw Jesus. Now, I don't know if I saw Jesus. I've never been able to draw a definitive conclusion, but I had a dream that I saw somebody who looked like Jesus. And when I woke up, I felt like, whoa, this is a weird dream. This isn't the normal, everyday dream. And in the context of that dream, not totally because of the dream, but partially, I decided to go to church, something I had never done seriously before, and I decided to pick up a New Testament and read it, partly because of that dream I had. Now, could it be that that dream was just, you know, the brain, apparently the brain does a lot of processing while you're asleep, and there's a lot of weird things that happen, you know. Sometimes I've had dreams and I was aware, you know what, Ken, you're dreaming right now. I am? Yeah. I mean, dreams are weird. But I had a dream where I thought I saw, I'll tell you the dream. I was in it. It appeared like I was in a cave and I had a robe on. And I looked and it looked like that there was a hole in the cave, almost like a window. And a man's face appeared in the cave. And I remember thinking that man's face looks like he had been beaten. Now, I woke up, I was sweaty and nervous, and I was like, this is weird. So I told my friends about it. I told my mother about it. I don't know. Maybe, Joe, maybe I ate spicy food that night.
Could be. That happens to me.
you know, or maybe I watched a weird TV program and I processed it. But all I do know is my friend that I knew from first grade, who was also shy, by the way. That's how we got left over at lunch and we were crying because we couldn't go out to play recess and we met each other. Mm. We were friends for a long time. He said, you know, Ken, your life has changed. It looks like your life is almost black and white. You do things now you've never done before, and there are things you used to do you don't do anymore. Partly because of the dream. Mm. Now, do I know that that dream was veridical, that it matches reality? I don't. And quite frankly, I tend to be skeptical about things like that. I would say, but it seems to fit with the idea that maybe I had an authentic relationship with God and that dream was part of it.
Maybe if you were more open, you'd have more dreams.
Well, I've been told that before by you. No. let's look at history. There's credible historical reports that corroborate the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. There are first century and second century Roman historians who mention Jesus. Now, they're rather cryptic. None of these first century Roman historians actually met Jesus, nor did they see him risen from the dead, but they encountered Christians, and they were aware that these Christians were meeting in the name of Jesus. And then there are Jewish writers and historians, people like Josephus, and they mention Jesus. And then there are Greek thinkers that mention him. And what do they say about him? Well, he was a teacher from Galilee. He taught in parables. He claimed to do miracles. He was persecuted and arrested by the Romans and put to death by Pontius Pilate. And then his followers say that he appeared to them after he had been killed. And this superstition, as the Romans called it, has come all the way to Rome. Now, what's interesting, that's not very much information. Mm-hmm. And none of these Roman, Greek, Jewish people ever saw Jesus, but nothing that they say contradicts what we find in the New Testament. Now, people will say, why isn't there a lot more? Well, remember, at that point, nobody knew Christianity was going to become the dominant religion of the religious empire. Nobody knew that two centuries later, there a third of the world's population would be followers of Jesus. Mm. But it's consistent, mm-hmm. right? And then philosophy. Human beings crave meaning, purpose, and immortality. There are three thinkers that I'm very fond of, and I've asked myself, why am I fond of these three figures? And I think partly because they have a similar way of thinking and communicating ideas. The three people are, in historical order, St. Augustine, Blaise Pascal, and C.S. Lewis. All of them, St. Augustine, probably his most famous line from his book Confessions, that we're restless and we're seeking rest and peace, and we can't find it without God. Blaise Pascal talks about kind of a void inside us that can't be filled by anything other than Jesus Christ. C.S. Lewis has the argument from desire, that we seem longing. we seem to be longing for something, and it doesn't appear that anything in this world can satisfy it. And Lewis argues maybe that's an indication that there is something else going on behind the scenes. Now, none of these arguments are deductive. None of these are probabilistic based. I'm not sure there's any way to kind of test these arguments the way we might test a hypothesis. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I draw them to be kind of explanatory theories. They seem to be, Joe, a doctor looking at symptoms and drawing a diagnosis.
So it's kind of like if you had, say, several different theories, and each one of them, you got a point if you could explain one of these 8 or 10 things that you've listed here, and you add up the score at the bottom,
yeah,
and the one that has the highest score is the most likely,
yeah,
explanation.
Yeah.
And Christianity is the most, probably, yeah, the one with the highest score.
And if I might, let me take one more provocative element at this last idea of meaning and purpose and this idea of yearning. Again, Augustine, it's this restlessness. Augustine says in his book, The Confessions, in a prayer to God, Lord, you've made us for yourself, and we can't find rest and peace until we find it in you. And so the context of our life is God, and outside of God, we're restless, right? Seems to be kind of a universal condition. You know, accumulating a lot of money is not a guarantee that you're going to be deeply satisfied. Aristotle had the term eudaimonia, a deep sense of satisfaction or fulfillment.
Mm-hmm.
Money is not a bad thing. Love of money can cripple you, maybe devastate you. Money is a tool. It can be a good thing. But there's no guarantee that the accumulation of a lot of it will make you fulfilled, satisfied. Mm-hmm. Having sex with lots of people might be fun, but people who've done it don't seem to be deeply fulfilled and satisfied, mm-hmm, although they put on a pretty good act.
Mm-hmm.
We seem to have this inner void. We seem to be longing. And I guess the point I want to make there in a broader context is I still experience that. Even though I know God and I have a relationship with him, I still feel like there's an ache. I still have a longing. I guess a longing to be with God in a world without sin and in a world in which I'm morally transformed into his image and live in a community of saintly people. But that's a longing. That's an ache, mm-hmm, that I have. And there are times where I think, how come these things don't fulfill me more than they should? Well, again, that's kind of that diagnostician, mm-hmm, idea. And Dave, as you've kind of summarized, if we look at this collection, Joe, of these various things, an abductive approach would say that these realities, these issues, these ideas, they appear to be real, and they seem to be plausibly explained by Christianity. And the fact that there are so many of them, and the fact that they are so diverse, would seem to add a cumulative support, mm-hmm, for it. Now, again, and it's important, I think, to understand the logic, some people might say, well, but none of them are totally convincing. None of them are knockdown arguments. None of them are proofs. Right, they're not. But how many proofs do we typically have in life? Life doesn't give us a lot of knockdown proofs. A lot of times we're kind of trying to plausibly put things together and to reason about them. You know, another person might say, well, they're all leaky buckets. There is an alternative explanation to nearly every one of them.
Mm-hmm.
That's true, but sometimes the alternative explanations seem
kind of extreme.
Ad hoc. Yeah. They seem highly implausible. I mean, the idea of explaining the resurrection by proposing that Mary had two children and one of them was put up for adoption and who came back, the twin brother theory. Well, I guess if the supernatural can't happen, then any alternative theory would have some plausibility, but that seems a stretch. So in one sense, I think I think all of us, I'm going to go back to a previous program. I think when we are sleeping in on Saturday morning and we open the blind and we see the street wet, we intuitively, naturally draw a conclusion about it. What's the explanation? It rained. And of course, you could be wrong because I think it's the second Tuesday of the month in my neighborhood, the street sweeper comes through. So there is a way of saying, well, wait a second, that intuition may not be what you think it is. But I think we are kind of built that way. We're built to kind of draw these, and I guess, you know, the pursuit of a rational life is then to give consideration how much of this can we best explain according to these kinds of issues. I think Christian theism makes sense. I think it makes sense to be a Christian. I think Christian theism has explanatory power and scope. And with Buddhism, with Hinduism, with naturalism, I don't think they have nearly the scope of explanation as does Christian theism.
There are a few. I read something recently by this. Is it Thomas Nagel?
Thomas Nagel.
He seems to be an atheist philosopher who will acknowledge all of the things that we're saying here, but he doesn't want it to be true.
Yeah. It seems, Dave, that there are two different kinds of responses on the part of a believer. I owe this point to a talk that I went to the ISCA convention, the International Society of Christian Apologetics. One of the speakers, and I can't seem to remember his name, he said there are two types of skeptical responses. And he mentioned Nagel as one. Mm-hmm. Nagel says, well, Christianity is rational, but it's not appealing. Mm-hmm. I don't want it to be true. Right. I don't want there to be that kind of God. He said there are other people who look at it and say, it's appealing. I wish it were true, but it's not rational.
Right.
And it,
you just get these two together now.
Yeah. If it could be rational and appealing, then we might embrace it.
Okay, great. Thank you for that. So multiple lines of converging evidence support and verify the Christian worldview's basic truth claims. That's a good way to summarize it.
Yeah.
This is found in your book, Ken, Seven Truths That Change the World, which we highly recommend. Here at RTB. Another book that we've been recommending on previous podcasts is your latest, God Among Sages. If you do not have that book, please get a copy. In fact, get two copies, God Among Sages, Ken's latest book, and you will not be disappointed. All right, for Ken Samples and Dave Rogstad, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory but truth. Thanks for listening and join us for the next edition of Imago Dei.
We'd like to thank our monthly partners for making this broadcast possible. If you're not a monthly partner or would like information about becoming one, please go to reasons.org/monthly partners. Also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where you can join the conversation about the latest scientific discoveries, headlines, and their apologetic value.